Chokmah. Chapter 3. In hanc utilitatem clementes angeli sepe figuras caracteres formas et voces invenerunt proposuerunque nobis mortalibus et ignotas et stupendas nullius rei iuxta consuetum linguae usum significativas. Sed per rationis nostrae summam admirationem in assiduam intelligibilium per vestigationem deinde in illorum ipsorum venerationem et amorem inductivas. Johannes Reuchlin, De Arte Cabalistica, Hagenau, 1517, Volume 3. It had been 2 days earlier, a Thursday. I was lazing in bed, undecided about getting up. I'd arrived the previous afternoon and had telephoned my office. Theo Talevi was still in the hospital, and Gudrun sounded pessimistic. Condition unchanged, in other words, getting worse. I couldn't bring myself to go and visit him. Belbo was away. Gudrun told me he telephoned to say he had to go somewhere for family reasons. What family? The odd thing was, he took away the word processor, Abulafia, he called it, and the printer, too. Gudrun also told me he had set it up at home in order to finish some work. Why had he gone to all that trouble? Couldn't he do it in the office? I felt like a displaced person. Leah and the baby wouldn't be back until next week. The previous evening I dropped by Pilates, but found no one there. The phone woke me. It was Belbo, his voice different, remote. Where the hell are you, lost in the jungle? Don't joke, Kasabin. This is serious. I'm in Paris. Paris? But I was the one who was supposed to go to the conservatoire. Stop joking, dammit. I'm in a booth, in a bar. I may not be able to talk much longer. If you're running out of change, call collect. I'll wait here. Change isn't the problem. I'm in trouble. He was talking fast, not giving me time to interrupt. The plan is real. I know, don't say it. They're after me. Who? I still couldn't understand. The Templars, Kasabin, for God's sake. You won't want to believe this, I know, but it's all true. They think I have the map. They tricked me, made me come to Paris. At midnight Saturday, they want me at the Conservatoire. Saturday, you understand. St. John's Eve. He was talking disjointedly, and I couldn't follow him. I don't want to go. I'm on the run, Kasabin. They'll kill me. Tell De Angelis. No, De Angelis is useless. Keep the police out of it. Then what do you want me to do? I don't know. Read the floppy disks. Use Abulafia. I put everything there these last few days, including all that happened this month. You weren't around. I didn't know who to tell it to. I wrote for 3 days and three nights. Listen, go to the office. In my desk drawer, there's an envelope with two keys in it. The large one you don't need. It's the key to my house in the country. But the small one's for the Milan apartment. Go there and read everything, then decide for yourself. Or maybe we'll talk. Oh, my God, I don't know what to do. All right, but where can I find you? I don't know. I change hotels here every night. Do it today and wait at my place tomorrow morning. I'll call if I can. Oh, my God, the password!
I heard noises. Belbo's voice came closer, moved away, as if someone was wrestling the receiver from him.
Belbo, what's going on? They found me! The word!
A sharp report, like a shot. It must have been the receiver falling, slamming against the wall or onto that little shelf they have under telephones. A scuffle. Then the click of the receiver being hung up. Certainly not by Belbo. I took a quick shower to clear my head. I couldn't figure out what was going on. The plan real? Absurd. We had invented it ourselves. But who had captured Belbo? The Rosicrucians? The Comte de Saint-Germain? The Okrana? The Knights of the Temple? The Assassins? Anything was possible, if the impossible was true. But Belbo might have gone off the deep end. He had been very tense lately, whether because of Lorenzo Pellegrini or because he was becoming more and more fascinated by his creature. The plan, actually, was our creature, his, mine, Dio Talevi's. But Belbo was the one who seemed obsessed by it now, beyond the confines of the game. It was useless to speculate further. I went to the office. Gudrun welcomed me with the acid remark that she had to keep the business going all on her own. I found the envelope, the keys, and rushed to Belbo's apartment. The stale, rancid smell of cigarette butts, the ashtrays all brimming, the kitchen sink piled high with dirty dishes, the garbage bin full of disemboweled cans. On a shelf in the study, three empty bottles of whiskey, and a little left, two fingers, in a fourth bottle. This was the apartment of a man who had worked non-stop for days without budging, eating only when he had to, working furiously, like an addict. There were two rooms in all, books piled in every corner, shelves sagging under their weight, the table with the computer, printer, and boxes of discs, a few pictures in the space not occupied by shelves. Directly opposite the table, a 17th-century print carefully framed, an allegory I hadn't noticed last month when I came up to have a beer before going off on my vacation. On the table, a photograph of Lorenzo Pellegrini with an inscription in a tiny, almost childish hand. You saw only her face, but her eyes were unsettling, the look in her eyes. In a gesture of instinctive delicacy, or jealousy, I turned the photograph face down, not reading the inscription. There were folders. I looked through them. Nothing of interest, only accounts, publishing cost estimates. But in the midst of these papers, I found the printout of a file that, to judge by its date, must have been one of Belbo's first experiments with the word processor. It was titled Abu. I remembered, when Abulafia had made its appearance in the office, Belbo's infantile enthusiasm, Gudrun's muttering, Diotalevi's sarcasm. Abu had been Belbo's private reply to his critics, a kind of sophomoric joke, but it said a lot about the combinatory passion with which he had used the machine. Here was a man who had said, with his wan smile, that once he realized that he would never be a protagonist, he decided to become, instead, an intelligent spectator, for there was no point in writing without serious motivation. Better to rewrite the books of others, which is what a good editor does. And Belbo found in the machine a kind of LSD and ran his fingers over the keyboard as if inventing variations on the Happy Farmer on the old piano at home, without fear of being judged. Not that he thought he was being creative. Terrified as he was by writing, he knew that this was not writing, but only the testing of an electronic skill, a gymnastic exercise. But forgetting the usual ghosts that haunted him, he discovered that playing with the word processor was a way of giving vent to a 50-year-old's second adolescence. His natural pessimism, his reluctant acceptance of his own past, were somehow dissolved in this dialogue with a memory that was inorganic, objective, obedient, non-moral, transistorized, and so humanly inhuman that it enabled him to forget his chronic nervousness about life. File name, Abu. Oh, what a beautiful morning at the end of November, and the beginning was the word. Sing to me, goddess, the son of Peleus, Achilles, now is the winter of our discontent. Period, new paragraph. Testing, testing. Paracalo, paracalo, with the right program you can even make anagrams. If you've written a novel with a Confederate hero named Rhett Butler and a fickle girl named Scarlet, and then change your mind, all you have to do is punch a key, and Abu will global replace the Rhett Butlers to Prince Andres, the Scarlets to Natasha's, Atlanta to Moscow, and lo, you've written War and Peace. Abu, do another thing now. Belbo orders Abu to change all words. Make each A become Akka, and each O become Allah, for a paragraph to look almost Finnish. Akabu, dala akanalother thing nalau. Belbala alarders, Akabu, tala chakange, akal wallards. Makake ikich, Akka, bikalam, Akakaka, Akand, Ikich, Alla, Bikalam, Alaka, Falar, Aka, Pakaraka, Grakaf, Tala, Lala, Alak, Akalama last finish. Oh joy! Oh new vertigo of difference! Oh my platonic reader-writer racked by a most platonic insomnia! Oh wake of Finnegan! Oh animal charming and benign! He doesn't help you think, but he helps you because you have to think for him. A totally spiritual machine. If you write with a goose quill, you scratch the sweaty pages and keep stopping to dip for ink. Your thoughts go too fast for your aching wrist. If you type, the letters cluster together and again you must go at the pokey pace of the mechanism, not the speed of your synapses. But with him, it, her, your fingers dream, your mind brushes the keyboard. You are born on golden pinions. At last you confront the light of critical reason with the happiness of a first encounter. And lo, what I do now. I tack this pack of spelling monstrosities, and I order the machin to copy them and file them in temory memory, and then bring them back from the limbo onto the screen, following its cell. There, I was typing blindly, but now I have taken that pack of spelling monstrosities and ordered the machine to copy the mess, and on the copy I made all the corrections, so it comes out perfect on the page. From shit, thus, I extract pure shinola. Repenting, I could have deleted the first draft. I left it to show how the is and the ought, accident and necessity, can coexist on this screen. If I wanted, I could remove the offending passage from the screen, but not from the memory, thereby creating an archive of my repressions, while denying omnivorous Freudians and virtuosi of variant texts the pleasure of conjecture, the exercise of their occupation, their academic glory. This is better than real memory, because real memory, at the cost of much effort, learns to remember, but not to forget. Diotelevi goes sephardically mad over those palaces with grand staircases, that statue of a warrior doing something unspeakable to a defenseless woman, the corridors with hundreds of rooms, each with the depiction of a portent, and the sudden apparitions, disturbing incidents, walking mummies. To each memorable image you attach a thought, a label, a category, a piece of the cosmic furniture, syllogisms, an enormous sorites, chains of apothems, strings of hypalogies, rosters of zeugmas, dances of hysteron proteron, apophantic logoi, hierarchic stoichia, processions of equinoxes and parallaxes, herbaria, genealogies of gymnosophists, and so on to infinity. O Raimundo, O Camillo, you had only to cast your mind back to your visions, and immediately you could reconstruct the great chain of being in love and joy, because all that was disjointed in the universe was joined in a single volume in your mind, and Proust would have made you smile. But when Diotelevi and I tried to construct an Ars Oblivionalis that day, we couldn't come up with the rules for forgetting. It's impossible. It's one thing to go in search of a lost time, chasing label clues, like Hop o' My Thumb in the woods, and quite another deliberately to misplace time refound. Hop o' My Thumb always comes home like an obsession. There is no discipline of forgetting. We are at the mercy of random natural processes, like stroke and amnesia, and such self-interventions as drugs, alcohol, or suicide. Abu, however, can perform on himself precise local suicides, temporary amnesias, painless aphasias. Where were you last night, L? There, indiscreet reader. You will never know it, but that half-line hanging in space was actually the beginning of a long sentence that I wrote, but then wished I hadn't. Wished I hadn't even thought, let alone written it. Wished that it had never happened. So I pressed a key, and a milky film spread over the fatal and inopportune lines, and I pressed delete, and whoosh, all gone. But that's not all. The problem with suicide is that sometimes you jump out the window and then change your mind between the 8th floor and the 7th. Oh, if only I could go back. Sorry, you can't. Too bad. Splat. Abu, on the other hand, is merciful. He grants you the right to change your mind. You can recover your deleted text by pressing retrieve. What a relief. Once I know that I can remember whenever I like, I forget. Never again will I go from one bar to another, disintegrating alien spacecraft with tracer bullets, until the invader monster disintegrates me. This is far more beautiful. Here you disintegrate thoughts instead of aliens. The screen is a galaxy of thousands and thousands of asteroids, all in a row, white or green, and you have created them yourself. Fiat lux, big bang, 7 days, 7 minutes, 7 seconds, and a universe is born before your eyes, a universe in constant flux, where sharp lines in space and time do not exist. No numerous Clausius here, no constraining law of thermodynamics. The letters bubble indolently to the surface, they emerge from nothingness and obediently return to nothingness, dissolving like ectoplasm. It's an underwater symphony of soft linkings and unlinkings, a gelatinous dance of self-devouring moons, like the big fish in the yellow submarine. At a touch of your fingertip, the irreparable slides backward toward a hungry word and disappears into its maw with a slurp, then darkness. If you don't stop, the word swallows itself as well, fattening on its own absence like a Cheshire Cat black hole.
and if you happen to write what modesty forbids, it all goes onto a floppy disk, and you can give the disk a password, and no one will be able to read you. Excellent for secret agents. You write the message, save it, then put the disk in your pocket and walk off. Not even Torquemada could find out what you've written. It's between you and it. It, capital I. And if they torture you, you pretend to confess. You start entering the password, then press a secret key and the message disappears forever. Oh, I'm so sorry. You say my hand slipped. An accident, and now it's gone. What was it? I don't remember. It wasn't important. I have no message to reveal. But later on, who knows? I might.
Chapter 4. He who attempts to penetrate into the rose garden of the philosophers without the key resembles a man who would walk without feet. Michael Meyer, Atalanta Fugens, Oppenheim, Debris, 1618. Emblem 27.
That was the only file that had been printed out. I would have to go through the disks on the computer. They were arranged by number, and I thought I might as well start with the first. But Belbo had mentioned a password. He had always been possessive with Abulathea's secrets. When I loaded the machine, a message promptly appeared. Do you have the password? Not in the imperative. Belbo was a polite man. The machine doesn't volunteer its help. It must be given the word. Without the word, it won't talk. As though it were saying, "Yes, what you want to know is right here in my guts. Go ahead and dig, dig, old mole. You'll never find it."
We'll see about that, I said to myself.
You got such a kick out of playing with Diotalevi's permutations and combinations, and you were the Sam Spade of publishing. As Jacopo Belbo would have said, find the falcon.
The password to get into Abulafia had to be 7 letters or fewer. Letters or numbers. How many groups of 7 could be made from all the letters of the alphabet, including the possibility of repetition, since there was no reason the word couldn't be Kadabra? I knew the formula. The number was 6 billion and something. A giant calculator, capable of running through all 6 billion at the rate of 1 million per second, would still have to feed them to Abulafia one at a time, and it took Abulafia about 10 seconds to ask for the password and verify it. That made 60 billion seconds. There were over 31 million seconds in a year, say 30 to have a round figure. It would take, therefore, 2,000 years to go through all the possibilities. Nice work. I would have to proceed instead by inductive guesswork. What word would Belbo have chosen? Was it a word he had decided on at the start, when he began using the machine? Or was it one he had come up with only recently, when he realized that these disks were dangerous, and that for him at least the game was no longer a game? This would make a big difference. Better assume the latter, I thought. Belbo feels he is being hunted by the plan, which he now takes seriously, as he told me on the phone. For a password, then, he would use some term connected with our story. But maybe not. A term associated with the tradition might also occur to them. Then I thought, what if they had already broken into the apartment and made copies of the disks and were now at this very moment trying all the combinations of letters in some remote place, using the supreme computer in a castle in the Carpathians? Nonsense, I told myself. They weren't computer people. They would use the Notaricon, the Gematria, the Temura, treating the disks like the Torah, and therefore would require as much time as had passed since the writing of the Sefer Yetzirah. No, if they existed, they would proceed cabalistically, and if Belbo believed that they existed, he would follow the same path. Just to be on the safe side, I tried the 10 Sefirot. Keter, Chokma, Bina, Chesed, Gevura, Tiferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, Malkut. They didn't work, of course. It was the first thing that would have occurred to anyone. Still, the word had to be something obvious, something that would come to mind at once, because when you work on a text as obsessively as Belbo must have during the past few days, you can't think of anything else, of any other subject. It would not be human for him to drive himself crazy over the plan and at the same time pick Lincoln or Mombasa for the password. The password had to be connected with the plan. But what? I tried to put myself inside Belbo's head. He had been chain-smoking as he wrote, and drinking. I went to the kitchen for a clean glass, found only one, poured myself the last of the whiskey, sat down at the keyboard again, leaned back in the chair, and propped my feet on the table. I sipped my drink, wasn't that how Sam Spade did it? Or was it Philip Marlowe? And looked around. The books were too far away, I couldn't read the titles on their spines. I finished the whiskey, shut my eyes, opened them again. Facing me was the 17th-century engraving, a typical Rosicrucian allegory of the period, rich in coded messages addressed to the members of the fraternity. Obviously it depicted the Temple of the Rosy Cross, a tower surmounted by a dome in accordance with the Renaissance iconographic model, both Christian and Jewish, of the Temple of Jerusalem, reconstructed on the pattern of the Mosque of Omar. The landscape around the tower was incongruous and inhabited incongruously, like one of those rebuses where you see a palace, a frog in the foreground, a mule with its pack, and a king receiving a gift from a page. In the lower left was a gentleman emerging from a well, clinging to a pulley that was attached, through ridiculous winches, to some point inside the tower, the rope passing through a circular window. In the center were a horseman and a wayfarer. On the right, a kneeling pilgrim held a heavy anchor as though it were his staff. Along the right margin, almost opposite the tower, was a precipice from which a character with a sword was falling, and on the other side, foreshortened, stood Mount Ararat, the ark aground on its summit. In each of the upper corners was a cloud illuminated by a star that cast oblique rays along which two figures floated, a nude man in the coils of a serpent and a swan. At the top center, a nimbus was surmounted by the word Oriens, and bore Hebrew letters from which the hand of God emerged to hold the tower by a string. The tower moved on wheels. Its main part was square, with windows, a door, and a drawbridge on the right. Higher up, there was a kind of gallery with four observation turrets, each turret occupied by an armed man who waved a palm branch and carried a shield decorated with Hebrew letters. Only three of these men were visible. The fourth had to be imagined, since he was behind the octagonal dome, from which rose a lantern, also octagonal, with a pair of great wings affixed. Above the winged lantern was another smaller cupola, with a quadrangular turret whose open arches, supported by slender columns, revealed a bell inside. To the final small four-vaulted dome at the top was tied the thread held by the hand of God. The word Fa/Ma appeared here, and above that a scroll that read, Collegium Fraternitatis. There were other oddities. An enormous arm, out of all proportion to the figures, jutted from a round window in the tower on the left. It held a sword and belonged perhaps to the winged creature shut up in the tower. From a similar window on the right jutted a great trumpet. Once again, the trumpet. The number of openings in the tower drew my attention. There were too many of them, and the ones in the dome were too regular, whereas the ones in the base seemed random. Since only half the tower was shown in this orthogonal perspective, you could assume that symmetry was preserved and the doors, windows, and portholes on this side were repeated in the same order on the other side. That would mean, altogether, four arches in the dome of the bell tower, eight windows in the lower dome, four turrets, six openings in the east and west facades, and 14 in the north and south facades. I added it up. 36. For more than 10 years that number had haunted me. The Rosicrucians. 120 divided by 36 came to 3.333333, going to 7 digits. Almost too perfect, but it was worth a try. I tried and failed. It occurred to me then that the same number multiplied by 2 yielded the number of the beast, 666. That guess also proved too far-fetched. Suddenly I was struck by the nimbus in the middle, the divine throne. The Hebrew letters were large. I could see them from my chair. But Belbo couldn't write Hebrew on Abulafia. I took a closer look. I knew them, of course, from right to left. Yod, He, Vav, He. The Tetragrammaton. Yahweh, the name of God. Chapter 5. And begin by combining this name, Yahweh, at the beginning alone, and examine all its combinations, and move it and turn it about like a wheel, front and back, like a scroll. And do not let it rest, but when you see its matter strengthened because of the great motion, because of the fear of confusion of your imagination and the rolling about of your thoughts, and when you let it rest, return to it, and ask it, until there shall come to your hand a word of wisdom from it.
Do not abandon it. Abulafia, Haya Hanefes, Manuscript, Munchen, 408, Folios 65a to 65b.
The name of God. Of course. I remembered the first conversation between Belbo and Diotalevi, the day Abulafia was set up in the office. Diotalevi was at the door of his room, pointedly tolerant. Diotalevi's tolerance was always exasperating, but Belbo didn't seem to mind it. He tolerated it.
It won't be of any use to you, you know. You're not planning, surely, to rewrite the manuscripts you don't read anyway.
It's for filing, making schedules, updating lists. If I write a book with it, it'll be my own, not someone else's.
You swore that you'd never write anything of your own.
That I wouldn't inflict a manuscript on the world, true, when I concluded I wasn't cut out to be a protagonist.
You decided you'd be an intelligent spectator. I know all that. And so?
If an intelligent spectator hums the second movement on his way home from the concert, that doesn't mean he wants to conduct it in Carnegie Hall.
So you'll try humming literature to make sure you don't write any.
It would be an honest choice.
You think so?
Diotalevi and Belbo, both from Piedmont, often claimed that any good Piedmontese had the ability to listen politely, look you in the eye, and say, "You think so?" in a tone of such apparent sincerity that you immediately felt his profound disapproval.
I was a barbarian, they used to say. Such subtleties would have always been lost on me.
Barbarian? I would protest. I may have been born in Milan, but my family came from Valdosta.
Nonsense, they said. You can always tell a genuine Piedmontese immediately by his skepticism.
I'm a skeptic.
No, you're only incredulous, a doubter, and that's different.
I knew why Diotalevi distrusted Abulafia. He had heard that word processors could change the order of letters. A text thus might generate its opposite and result in obscure prophecies.
It's a game of permutation, Belbo said, trying to explain.
Tamura, isn't that the name for it? Isn't that what the devout rabbi does to ascend to the gates of splendor?
My dear friend, Diotalevi said, you'll never understand anything.
It's true that the Torah, the visible Torah, that is only one of the possible permutations of the letters of the eternal Torah, as God created it and delivered it to the angels. By rearranging the letters of the book over the centuries, we may someday arrive again at the original Torah. But the important thing is not the finding, it is the seeking. It is the devotion with which one spins the wheel of prayer and scripture, discovering the truth little by little. If this machine gave you the truth immediately, you would not recognize it, because your heart would not have been purified by the long quest.
And in an office? No. The book must be murmured day after day in a little ghetto hovel where you learn to lean forward and keep your arms tight against your hips, so there will be as little space as possible between the hand that holds the book and the hand that turns the pages. And if you moisten your fingers, you must raise them vertically to your lips, as if nibbling unleavened bread, and drop no crumb. The word must be eaten very slowly. It must melt on the tongue before you can dissolve it and reorder it. And take care not to slobber it onto your captain. If even a single letter is lost, the thread that is about to link you with the higher Sephirot is broken. To this, Abraham Abulafia dedicated his life, while your St. Thomas was toiling to find God with his five paths. Abraham Abulafia's Chochmat Chazeruf was at once the science of the combination of letters and the science of the purification of the heart. Mystic logic, letters whirling in infinite change, is the world of bliss. It is the music of thought. But see that you proceed slowly and with caution, because your machine may bring you delirium instead of ecstasy. Many of Abulafia's disciples were unable to walk the fine line between contemplation of the names of God and the practice of magic. They manipulated the names in an effort to turn them into a talisman, an instrument of dominion over nature, unaware, as you are unaware with your machine, that every letter is bound to a part of the body, and shifting a consonant without the knowledge of its power may affect a limb, its position, or nature. And then you find yourself deformed, a monster, physically for life, spiritually for eternity.
Listen, Belbo said to him then. You haven't discouraged me, you know. On the contrary. I have Abulafia, that's what I'm calling him, at my command, the way our friends used to have the golem. Only my Abulafia will be more cautious and respectful, more modest.
The problem is to find all the permutations of the name of God, isn't it? Well, this manual has a neat little program in BASIC for listing all possible sequences of four letters. It seems tailor-made for Yahweh. Should I give it a whirl? And he showed Diotalevi the program. Diotalevi had to agree it looked Kabbalistic. Try it yourself. When it asks for input, type YHVH and press the Enter key. But you may be disappointed. There are only 24 possible permutations. Holy Seraphim, what can you do with 24 names of God? You think our wise men hadn't made that calculation? Read the Sefer Yetzirah, chapter 4, section 16. And they didn't have computers. Two stones make two houses. Three stones make six houses. Four stones make 24 houses. Five stones make 120 houses. Six stones make 720 houses. Seven stones make 5,040 houses. Beyond this point, think of what the mouth cannot say and the ear cannot hear. You know what that is called today? Factor analysis. And you know why the tradition warns that beyond this point a man should quit? Because if there were eight letters in the name of God, there would be 40,320 permutations, and if ten, there would be 3,628,800, and the permutations of your own wretched little name, first name and last, would come to almost 40 million. Thank God you don't have a middle initial like so many Americans, because then there would be more than 400 million. And if the names of God contain 27 letters, in the Hebrew alphabet there are no vowels, but 22 consonants plus 5 variants, then the number of his possible names would have 29 digits. Except that you have to allow for repetitions, because the name of God could be Aleph repeated 27 times, in which case factor analysis is of no use. With repetitions, you'd have to take 27 to the 27th power, which is, I believe, something like 444 billion 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 billion. 4 times 10 with 39 zeros after it. You're cheating. You're trying to scare me. I've read your Sefer Yetzirah, too. There are 22 fundamental letters, and with them alone, God formed all creation. Let's not split hairs. 5 at this order of magnitude won't help. If you say 22 to the 22nd power instead of 27 to the 27th, you still come up with something like 340 billion billion billion. On the human scale, it doesn't make much difference. If I counted 1, 2, 3, and so on, one number every second, it would take me almost 32 years to get to one lousy little billion. And it's more complicated than that, because Kabbalah can't be reduced to the Sefer Yetzirah alone. Besides which, there's a good reason why any real permutation of the Torah must include all 27 letters. It's true that if the last 5 letters fall in the middle of a word, they are transformed into their normal variant. But not always. In Isaiah 9:2, for instance, there's the word Lemarbach, which, note the coincidence, means to multiply, but the mem in the middle is written as a final mem. Why is that? Every letter corresponds to a number. The normal mem is 40, but the final mem is 600. This has nothing to do with Temura, which teaches permutation. It involves, rather, gematria, which seeks sublime affinities between words and their numeric values. With the final mem, the word Lemarbach totals not 277, but 837, and thus is equivalent to Tatzal, which means he who gives profusely. So you can see why all 27 letters have to be considered. It isn't just the sound that matters, but the number too. Which brings us to my calculation. There are more than 400 billion 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 possibilities. Have you any idea how long it would take to try them all out using a machine? And I'm not talking about your miserable little computer. At the rate of one permutation per second, you would need 7 billion 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 minutes, or 123 million billion 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 hours, which is a little more than 5 million billion 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 days, or 14,000 billion 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 years, which comes to 140 billion 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 centuries, or 14 billion 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 millennia. But suppose you had a machine capable of generating 1 million permutations per second. Just think of the time you'd save with your electronic wheel. You'd need only 14,000 billion billion millennia. The real and true name of God, the secret name, is as long as the entire Torah, and there is no machine in the world capable of exhausting all its permutations, because the Torah itself is a permutation with repetitions, and the art of Temura tells us to change not the 27 letters of the alphabet, but each and every character in the Torah, for each character is a letter unto itself, no matter how often it appears on other pages. The two Ches in the name Yahweh therefore count as two different letters. And if you want to calculate all the permutations of all the characters in the entire Torah, then all the zeros in the world will not be enough for you. But go ahead, do what you can with your pathetic little accountant's machine. A machine does exist, to be sure, but it wasn't manufactured in your Silicon Valley. It is the Holy Kabbalah, or tradition. And for centuries the rabbis have been doing what no computer can do, and, let us hope, will never be able to do. Because on the day all the combinations are exhausted, the result should remain secret, and in any case the universe will have completed its cycle, and we will all be consumed in the dazzling glory of the great metacyclosynchrotron.
Amen, Jacopo Belbo said. The Otalevi was already driving him toward these excesses, and I should have kept that in mind.
How often had I seen Belbo, after office hours, running programs to check Diotalevi's calculations, trying to show him that at least Abu could give results in a few seconds, not having to work by hand on yellowing parchment or use antediluvian number systems that did not even include zero. But Abu gave his answers in exponential notation, so Belbo was unable to daunt Diotalevi with a screen full of endless zeros, a pale visual imitation of the multiplication of combinatorial universes, of the exploding swarm of all possible worlds. After everything that had happened, it seemed impossible to me, I thought as I stared at the Rosicrucian engraving, that Belbo would not have returned to those exercises on the name of God in selecting a password. And if, as I guessed, he was also preoccupied with numbers like 36 and 120, they would enter into it too. He would not have simply combined the four Hebrew letters, knowing that four stones made only 24 houses. But he might have played with the Italian transcription, which contained two vowels. With six letters, Yahweh, he had 720 permutations at his disposal. The repetitions didn't count because Diotalevi had said that the two Ches must be taken as two different letters. Belbo could have chosen, say, the 36th or the 120th. I had arrived at Belbo's at about 11. It was now 1. I would have to write a program for anagrams of six letters, and the best way to do that was to modify the program I already had written for four. I needed some fresh air. I went out, bought myself some food, another bottle of whiskey. I came back, left the sandwiches in a corner, and started on the whiskey as I inserted the basic disk and went to work. I made the usual mistakes, and the debugging took me a good half hour, but by 2:30 the program was functional and the 720 names of God were running down the screen. I took the pages from the printer without separating them, as if I were consulting the scroll of the Torah. I tried name number 36, and drew a blank. A last sip of whiskey, then with hesitant fingers I tried name number 120. Nothing. I wanted to die. Yet I felt that by now I was Jacopo Belbo, that he had surely thought as I was thinking. So I must have made some mistake, a stupid trivial mistake. I was getting closer. Had Belbo, for some reason that escaped me, perhaps counted from the end of the list? Kasabin, you fool, I said to myself, of course he started from the end. That is, he counted from right to left. Belbo had fed the computer the name of God translated into Latin letters, including the vowels, but the word was Hebrew, so he had written it from right to left. The input hadn't been Yahweh, but Hevhai. The order of the permutations had to be inverted. I counted from the end and tried both names again. Nothing. This was all wrong. I was clinging stubbornly to an elegant but false hypothesis. It happens to the best scientists. No, not to the best scientists, to everyone. Only a month ago we had remarked that in three recent novels, at least three, there was a protagonist trying to find the name of God in a computer. Belbo would have been more original. Besides which, when you choose a password, you pick something easy to remember, something that comes to mind automatically. Ich verhehe, indeed. In that case, he would have had to apply the Notarikon to the Temura to invent an acrostic to remember the word. Something like, Imelda has vindicated Hiram's evil assassination. But why should Belbo have thought in Diotalevi's Kabbalistic terms? Belbo was obsessed by the plan, and into the plan we had put all sorts of other ingredients. Rosicrucians, Synarchy, Homunculi, the Pendulum, the Tower, the Druids, the Anoia. Anoia. I thought of Lorenza Pellegrini. I reached out, picked up her censored photograph, looked at it, and an inopportune thought surfaced, the memory of that evening in Piedmont. I read the inscription on the picture. "For I am the first and the last, the honored and the hated, the saint and the prostitute, Sophia." She must have written that after Ricardo's party. Sophia. 6 letters. And why would they need to be scrambled? I was the one with the devious mind. Belbo loves Lorenza, loves her precisely because she is the way she is, and she is Sophia. And at that very moment she might be... No, no good. Belbo was devious, too. I recalled Diotalevi's words. In the second sephira, the dark aleph changes into the luminous aleph. From the dark point spring the letters of the Torah. The consonants are the body, the vowels the breath, and together they accompany the worshipper as he chants. When the chant moves, the consonants and vowels move with it, and from them rises chokmah, wisdom, knowledge, the primordial thought that contains, as in a box, everything, all that will unfold in creation. Chokmah holds the essence of all that will emanate from it. And what was Abu Lafia with its secret files? The box that held everything Belbo knew, or thought he knew, his Sophia. With her secret name he would enter Abu Lafia, the thing, the only thing, he made love to. But making love to Abu Lafia, he thinks of Lorenza, so he needs a word that will give him possession of Abu Lafia, but also serve as a talisman to give him possession of Lorenza, to penetrate Lorenza's heart as he penetrates Abu Lafia's. But Abu Lafia should be impenetrable to others, as Lorenza is impenetrable to him. It is Belbo's hope that he can enter, know, and conquer Lorenza's secret in the same way that he possesses Abu Lafia. But I was making this up. My explanation was just like the plan, substituting wishes for reality. Drunk, I sat down at the keyboard again and tapped out Sophia. Again nothing, and again the machine asked me politely, "Do you have the password?" You stupid machine. You feel no emotion at the thought of Lorenza. Chapter 6. Hudaleon se dio a permutaciones de letras y a complejas variaciones, y al fin pronunció el nombre que es la clave, la puerta, el eco, el huésped y el palacio. Jorge Luis Borges, El Golem. And then, in a fit of hate, as I worked again at Abu Lafia's obtuse question, "Do you have the password?" I typed, "No." The screen began to fill with words, lines, codes, a flood of communication. I had broken into Abu Lafia. Thrilled by my triumph, I didn't ask myself why Belbo had chosen that, of all words. Now I know. And I know, too, that in a moment of lucidity he understood what I have come to understand only now. But last Thursday my only thought was that I had won. I danced, clapped my hands, sang an old army song. Then I went to the bathroom and washed my face. When I came back I began printing out the files, last files first, what Belbo had written just before his flight to Paris. As the printer chattered implacably, I devoured some food and drank some more whiskey. When the printer stopped and I read what Belbo had written, I was aghast, unable to decide whether this was an extraordinary revelation or the wild raving of a madman. What did I really know about Jacopo Belbo? What had I learned about him in the 2 years I worked at his side almost every day? How much faith could I put in the word of a man who, by his own admission, was writing under exceptional circumstances, in a fog of alcohol, tobacco, and terror, completely cut off from the world for 3 days? It was already night, Thursday, June 21st. My eyes were watering. I had been staring at the screen and then at the printer's pointless anthill since morning. What I had read might be true or might be false, but Belbo said he would call in the morning. I would have to wait here. My head swam. I staggered into the bedroom and fell, still dressed, onto the unmade bed. At around 8, I woke from a deep, sticky sleep, not realizing at first where I was. Luckily, I found a can of coffee and was able to make myself a few cups. The phone didn't ring. I didn't dare go out to buy anything because Belbo might call while I was gone. I went back to the machine and began printing out the other disks in chronological order. I found games, exercises, and accounts of events I knew about, but told from Belbo's private point of view, so that they were reshaped and appeared to me now in a different light.
I found diary fragments, confessions, outlines for works of fiction made with the bitter obstinacy of a man who knows that his efforts are doomed to failure. I found descriptions of people I remembered, but now I saw them with different faces, sinister faces, unless this was because I was seeing them as part of a horrible final mosaic. And I found a file devoted entirely to quotations taken from Belbo's most recent reading. I recognized them immediately. Together we had pored over so many texts during those months. The quotations were numbered, 120 in all. The number was probably a deliberate choice, if not, the coincidence was disturbing. But why those passages, and not others? Today I reinterpret Belbo's files, the whole story they tell, in the light of that quotation file. I tell the passages like the beads of a heretical rosary. For Belbo, some of them may have been an alarm, a hope of rescue. Or am I, too, no longer able to distinguish common sense from unmoored meaning? I try to convince myself that my reinterpretation is correct, but as recently as this morning someone told me, not Belbo, that I was mad. On the horizon beyond the Brico, the moon is slowly rising. This big house is filled with strange rustling sounds, termites perhaps, mice, or the ghost of Adelino Canepa. I dare not walk along the hall. I stay in Uncle Carlo's study and look out the window. From time to time I step onto the terrace to see if anyone is coming up the hill. I feel that I'm in a movie. How pathetic. Here come the bad guys. Yet the hill is so calm tonight, a summer night now. Adventurous, dubious, and demented were the events I reconstructed to pass the time and to keep up my spirits as I stood waiting in the periscope 2 nights ago, between 5 and 10 o'clock, moving my legs as if to some Afro-Brazilian beat to help the blood circulate. I thought back over the last few years, abandoning myself to the magic role of the atabax, accepting the revelation that our fantasies, begun as a mechanical ballet, were about to be transformed in this temple of things mechanical into right, possession, apparition, and the dominion of Exu. In the periscope I had no proof that what I had learned from the printout was true. I could still take refuge in doubt. At midnight, perhaps, I would discover that I had come to Paris and hidden myself like a thief in a harmless museum of technology, only because I had foolishly fallen into a macumba staged for credulous tourists, letting myself be hypnotized by the perfumadors and the rhythm of the pontos. As I recomposed the mosaic, my mood changed from disenchantment to pity to suspicion, and I wished that now I could rid myself of this present lucidity and recover that same vacillation between mystic illusion and the presentiment of a trap. Recover what I thought then as I mulled over the documents I had read so frantically the day before and reread that morning at the airport and during the flight to Paris. How irresponsibly Belbo, Diotelevi, and I had rewritten the world, or, as Diotelevi would have put it, had rediscovered what in the book had been engraved at white heat between the black lines formed by the letters, like black insects that supposedly made the Torah clear. And now, 2 days later, having achieved, I hope, serenity and amor fati, I can tell the story I reconstructed so anxiously, hoping it was false, inside the periscope, the story I had read 2 days ago in Belbo's apartment, the story I had lived for 12 years between Pilate's whiskey and the dust of Garamond Press.